I hope you notice that your speaker tonight is actually a kind of wannabe Episcopalian. Notice the blue blazer and the khaki slacks. Anyway. I want to say a few things about resources for Lutheran worship. If, in fact, any of you are seriously interested in the leadership of Lutheran worship in Lutheran congregations, and you are an Episcopalian, you need to know about these resources. My recommendation of these resources, however, is also going to the pastors of the ELCA, because sometimes one can adopt a liturgical book of the church and not profoundly plumb its depths, let us say, and not necessarily know the resources themselves that can help you plumb those depths. So a little bit about the resources in Lutheran worship. And then I'd like to say a tiny bit about the things that Lutheran worship has from the Anglican tradition, and specifically from the Book of Common Prayer of 1978. Then I'd like to just look through the ELW with you rather quickly. In doing that, there will be some moments in which I hope there will be a kind of response to a couple of things that Neil has said. And then I'd like to do that all quickly enough that you still have some time to ask me questions that may be from this afternoon's Eucharist or from our conversation generally this evening or otherwise. And in any case, by 7:30, then we will ask Neil to respond to what we've been doing, and then look for questions and answers again, maybe a little time, and once again move to a discussion group for at least a half an hour, and then come back to sing ELW evening prayer to conclude the evening. That's the plan, right? Okay. Resources. The truth of the matter is, the primary resource for worship in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is not the ELW. The primary resource for worship in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is this document. It's called On the Use of the Means of Grace, a statement on the practice of word and sacrament. This document has really more authority in the ELCA than do the rubrics or the notes on the service or the shape of the liturgy that is in the ELW. In fact, if you want to think of a hierarchy of resources and authority in the ELW, you've got to start with the Bible, and then you've got to move to the confessions. And in the ELCA, then you're going to move to the Use of the Means of Grace document, adopted in 1997 at the Churchwide Assembly in Philadelphia by a 95% positive vote. It's a counsel to the churches about the practice of word and sacrament. It's not canon law, but it's the closest thing we have. And it is genuinely counsel with a lot of possibilities. If you're interested in knowing what the ELCA counsels that parishes do in the practice of word and sacrament, look at the Use of the Means of Grace document. In fact, the Use of the Means of Grace document was adopted, and it was the work on preparing a new worship book proceeded only after that document was adopted. And then, on the model of the Use of the Means of Grace document, four statements that were called principles for worship about language for worship, about music for worship, about architecture for worship, and about preaching in worship, were all prepared by task forces that widely distributed and had reviewed the work that they did. So there was a wide discussion about those principles. So that there followed from the use of the Means of Grace document a church-wide discussion about those principles in worship. And all of that took place before trial services in the project that was called the Renewing Worship Project was underway, that led to the publication of Evangelical Lutheran Worship in 2006. You need to know, by the way, in relationship to these resources, that there are still Lutheran congregations that do not use this book. There are Lutheran congregations that use the last book, the Lutheran Book of Worship. There are Lutheran congregations that use the book before that, the service book and hymnal. There's even a few that use the common service book that Neil mentioned this morning. Remember what I said this morning. There is no requirement. These books have to win their way. They have to be, in order to be available as a worship resource in our church, they need to be reviewed and approved. So there is an ecclesial process toward their theological vetting and their church council review, but that doesn't mean they're required. But the ELW has very largely won its way. Maybe before we're done today and tomorrow, we could look again at, I'm thinking maybe tomorrow morning, the fascinating thing that Neil said, that the 78, 79 books of the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran churches in North America in many ways received the 20th century liturgical reform and were the concrete result of that reform, the many characteristics of which Neil accurately sketched. Then the question might be, then why the ELW? Why was there a next step? It's not unrelated to a question Episcopalians are asking. Is there a need for a next step? And I want to argue that there was, and I'll try to show you some of the reasons why I think that's true. So, use of the Means of Grace document. Then, there's the ELW. We'll look at its contents a little bit in a minute. But if you know the ELW, then you really ought to know the leader's edition of the ELW, not just the pew edition. And the more so because, in fact, the first pages of the leader's edition are a series of notes on the services, which are the expanded version of the rubrics, if you will. Sometimes people have said, a characteristic of the ELW is what many people have called soft rubrics. The ELW, unlike the prayer book, is not marked by shells and mays. It's marked by a lot of indicative sentences. This is what we do. Or, this might be what we do. But the notes on the services in the leader's edition of the ELW is way, way more marked by reasons why than you usually see in rubrics. There is a clear awareness that it won't work anymore to just say this is what we do. You got to say why. And the notes on the services in the ELW are much more characteristically marked by that kind of why. If you use the ELW, by the way, dear Lutheran pastors, and haven't spent some time reading the notes, I strongly recommend it. It's a kind of liberating experience, for one thing. There's a range of possible practice that is present in those notes that are really interesting, and a way in which teaching occurs that's very helpful. The other thing the Leader's Edition includes is a number of texts that are not fully present in the Pew Edition, and I'll call your attention to that in just a minute when we look through the ELW itself. In addition to the Leader's Edition, You also ought to know that there's some supplementary supportive materials, including three handbooks to the use of the ELW that also ought to be widely known. One of them on the church year, one of them on baptism and the pastoral offices in the ELW, and one of them on the Sunday Eucharist, just simply called the Sunday Assembly. That Sunday Assembly book is the only one I have along, but there's three. This is what they look like, that are what the further expansion of the rubrics in the book, and the further discussion, more extensive discussion about options and why. So if you are involved in practicing with the ELW, I really do recommend those handbooks. In addition, there's some books that are helpful resources in the circle of ELW materials. For example, there's an Indexes for Worship book bound very similarly to those handbooks that includes, for example, the indexes of the hymns of the day that we talked about earlier. And there's a whole variety of musical resources, including resources for psalmody. There's a handbook for Lent and the 3 days, and then a musical handbook for Lent and the 3 days, which expand what's available in the book itself for use. In fact, the worship staff of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and for that matter of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, both say that the ELW is what we call our core worship resource, but not our only one. It's at the core of a kind of expanding variety of possibilities that will be used around that central core in worship practice. In addition, part of that expanding core is a thing many of our pastors and congregations do know about. You may know about it online, or you may know about it in a single printed volume. It's called Sundays and Seasons. It's a set of alternate materials, sometimes alternate liturgical texts. It's a set of reflections on the readings for a given Sunday that can help in planning worship, can help in planning music, and can help in planning preaching. That's been expanded now by a second annual volume that's called Sundays and Seasons Preaching, which goes even further in the helping preachers prepare. If you are interested as an Episcopalian in Lutheran liturgical practice, that whole range of materials is there for your use. Starting with the use of the Means of Grace document, and then expanded in the core resource of Evangelical Lutheran worship, and in these supplementary resources that help in the use of Evangelical Lutheran worship. Second, when you look through the ELW, there really are some things, more than this short list, but there really are some things that it's very useful in this kind of environment for us to freely acknowledge that the Lutheran churches in North America have from the gift of Anglicans or in the gift from the Book of Common Prayer explicitly. I already talked about thanks to the good question of Catherine Johnson, I already talked about the Coverdale Psalter that is the historic liturgical psalter of Anglicanism that we're using. Amended, but we're using. I think that the recent accent that was in the LBW and is now also in the ELW on the laying on of hands and prayer at baptism as part of the baptismal rite is a gift that came into North American Lutheran consciousness from a conversation Episcopalians had on the way to what was published in the prayer book. In some ways, Lutherans achieved integrating what anciently was called confirmation into the baptismal rite, and you guys led the way. I know it didn't quite make it in prayer book use, but it really was Episcopalian discussion, those old prayer book studies, that had profound effect on the baptismal renewal process that saw that we had already had a conversation that made it clear that confirmation wasn't really going anywhere as a rite, that it needed to be thought about in our circles as a process of the baptized child coming to claim the baptismal faith and be integrated in the mission of a congregation. And that if there was a rite, the rite had to be a rite of affirmation of baptism. And increasingly it became clear that the rite of affirmation of baptism should be available at other times, at other change times in a person's life, not just late adolescence. So in fact, we wound up with the suggestions that the rite of the affirmation of baptism might be used, for example, in the adoption of a child, or might be used when someone is retiring, or by all means might be used when somebody returns from prison, as well as being used in what we still called, and our book still calls, confirmation. But confirmation as a separate rite did increasingly decline as we saw that, in fact, what had separated out from baptism in the Western development really belonged, still belongs in the Eastern Church, in baptism itself. And I want to say, while it was a gift that was the Episcopal Church itself was not quite ready to fully receive, your gift has had a powerful effect in Lutheran circles. You can see it in our books. And third, I want to say that the ELW devotion to elegant and clear English language in prayer is really a fruit of the centuries-long custodianship that Anglican churches have had to beautiful English in prayer. And I think that's had a powerful effect on Lutherans in English-speaking North America. I think you guys Episcopalians, have a little bit dropped the ball recently, to tell you the truth. I think that custodianship still is rightly yours. And I hope you pick it up and run with it. You've had a lot of other things to do. I know it. And it's not been a particularly fun time. But here is now a time. I think it's incumbent upon your brother in Christ to say to you, here is a time for you to, in fact, pick up that old custodianship again. We Lutherans are still largely just off the ship. You know, we're still mostly immigrant churches. There's a memory of that still alive. It's fascinating, but it's still alive. But the ELW is a serious attempt to try to do English language prayer beautifully. And I have to say that the Episcopal experience was inspiring to us in that regard. However, I will remember that the very idea of prayer in vernacular language was a export across the channel from the experience of German Christians, and especially those under the influence of Martin Luther. And I love it that the first prayer book, of course, was powerfully influenced by the liturgy that Philip Melanchthon and Martin Bucer drafted for the Archbishop of Cologne. And I love even more that Cranmer was actually for a while in Nuremberg and saw what they were doing in Nuremberg and even married the principal Lutheran pastor of Nuremberg's niece, so that Cranmer had a Lutheran in the house, if you will. So in the gift-giving, there has been a long time of mutual exchanges. But I just wanted to openly note at least those things. There probably would be more that have been influences that the prayer book tradition has had on North American Lutheran worship. When the common service was finally beginning to appear in late 19th century, that Neil has talked about so well and accurately, what Lutherans needed to do was to look at a way then to pray in English. And Cranmer was immensely important to us and remains important. Cranmer's doublets, the necessity of saying everything a little bit twice, is a brilliant liturgical language. Catherine Pickstock calls it liturgical stuttering. I think it is a kind of stuttering, but it's a beautiful stuttering. And it's, in fact, a lot like the doublets that you find in biblical speech. And Cranmer knew that and knew how to use it. Third, take the ELW in hand. If you open it, you'll see first a contents page. Introduction, the church year, the Holy Communion, with 10 musical settings, a service of the word listed at the end, Holy Baptism and rites related to Holy Baptism, Lent and the 3 days. An important thing to say about this book is that this book, unlike the LBW, has Lent, has the services of the 3 days, and of Ash Wednesday and the Sunday of the Passion, has these lined out briefly, but has them lined out in the pew book. The LBW did not. That's already a major reason why we needed the ELW. We needed this in the hands of the people to know that these liturgies belong to the church. Then life passages, those are the only pastoral offices, as it were, that make the ELW. But there is a ELW parallel volume called Pastoral Care, which is for a much expanded version of pastoral liturgical materials. By the way, I think what Neil said about liturgical pastoral care in our two churches is dead right on. And if you've never read it, let me recommend to you the book by Elaine Ramshaw, published by Fortress Press, called Ritual and Pastoral Care. It was published maybe 20 years ago. It's still the best thing available. It's still magnificently fine in thinking about how ritual is engaged in pastoral care, both the Sunday ritual and the pastoral offices. And then daily prayer, with morning prayer, evening prayer, and night prayer. More about that in a minute. And then, as I said to you, assembly song that begins with the 150 Psalms, then moves to a little section of service music, 151 to 238, so that not only are there 10 settings of Holy Communion, 10 musical settings, There is a whole set of service music, so that you could probably make up another five, at least, maybe another seven. There's a lot of ways to sing the liturgy here. And then the hymns themselves start at 239 and run to 886, a few national songs, and then a really interesting set of additional resources. Would you please turn to page 1121? You might like to know that in the LBW, published in the late 70s for us, I think the people preparing that book ran out of time and wanted a daily lectionary and realized that making a lectionary is a really hard job. And so the LBW simply published the daily lectionary of the Book of Common Prayer. For a long time, our daily lectionary was the same daily lectionary that's in the Book of Common Prayer. This is not that lectionary. And what you need to know is that this daily lectionary is like the ecumenically approved texts we have in common, prayers we have in common, which, by the way, are used throughout this book. This book is devoted to the idea that we should use the ecumenical texts, including the Lord's Prayer. I told you that we couldn't quite pull it off using only that text in the Sunday liturgy, but we did pull it off in the daily office. But the other shared ecumenical texts, the Kyrie, the Gloria, the salutation and response, the dialogue at the beginning of the Eucharist, those are here present in the way in which the English Language Liturgical Commission has published them in the latest edition of that publication. And the English Language Liturgical Commission, in cooperation with the Consultation on Common Texts, the North American partner of the English Language Liturgical Commission, also went to work on a daily lectionary. This is that lectionary. Is a lectionary... Actually, it began work from a publication that was originally a Fortress Press and Lutheran publication, and that then kind of expanded to being used ecumenically, and that group expanded it so it could be used ecumenically. It's a lectionary between Sundays. It is not marked by Calvinist in-course reading, like the daily lectionary in the prayer book is. I will never forget Neil's business about maybe we don't need to say the word of the Lord after these readings, and maybe here ends the reading, works fine. This daily lectionary, you will probably be less hesitant about the word of the Lord, because these readings are chosen to echo the readings of Sunday and anticipate the readings of the coming Sunday. So you see that they run from Thursday to Wednesday, as it were, a pool of readings around the Sunday in the center of those times. And that there is a psalm, actually two psalms for any given week. The psalm that leads up to the Sunday is the psalm, usually the psalm appointed in the lectionary for that Sunday, as the psalm for the Sunday, so you're preparing for that psalm use. And the psalm that follows the Sunday is a similar psalm, if you will. But the readings are intended to echo and prepare for the Sunday readings. I think that's a good idea. And I heartily recommend this lectionary to you. The reading we will read tonight is drawn from this lectionary, and the psalm that we will use as the second psalm tonight is similarly drawn from this lectionary. And it's, by the way, a three-year lectionary, not a two-year lectionary. So then if you turn on further, there's a little section beginning on page 1154 called Scripture and Worship. I can't believe how often the Bible quotes the Book of Common Prayer. Well, I can't believe how often the Bible quotes Evangelical Lutheran Worship, or vice versa. At least in Lutheran congregations, if you want to teach the liturgy, it behooves you to teach it biblically. And here is help for doing that. This was published originally in a little addition to a supplementary volume we had that was called With One Voice, kind of on the way to use it to making this book. And it's a resource for teaching that is really, I find, really wonderful. Then if you turn the page to 1160, you see that the decision was made that this book would include the Small Catechism. One of the confessional documents of the Lutheran Church is this text of Martin Luther's about teaching the texts of the Catechism, as I called it earlier today, teaching the texts of the Catechism in families. And so the Small Catechism is included, including the morning and evening blessings. In the morning, as soon as you get out of bed, you are to make the sign of the Holy Cross and say, God the Father, God the Son, and Holy Spirit, watch over me. Amen. That's one of the ways in which we've helped Lutherans learn that it's really okay to make the sign of the Holy Cross. Then there's a little indexes section. After first a report of the sources for which this material comes, if you want to know who composed a particular musical setting, then page 1170 is where you can find those sources. You can also find a little bit about the sources of the Eucharistic prayers. Information about copyrights, topical index of hymns, and then finally, of course, the standard way a hymnal ends, which is index of first lines. The indexes for worship, however, of a gray volume like those handbooks, is a much richer indexing tool that can help you in worship planning. That's what's at the back of the book. This gets us up to more than 1,100 pages, and there was a lot of wonder on the preparation of this book, how in the world you could create a book that people could actually hold in their hands and have it between two covers, and it worked. They found amazing paper and a fairly clear printing process, and I'm, on the whole, pretty proud of the result, including the wonderful cross becoming the tree of life, which is the logo on the front, and the amazing illustrations that are included in the front section of the book. We were sort of taught that by the way the German church has begun to publish their hymnals, with graphics included, and the graphics that have been included in this book, I think, are many of them stunning. For example, turn to page 223. And there is an image before the baptism section. Now, we don't all have fonts like that. But the very fact that our worship book has a picture of a font like that in it, I find really remarkable. It's a picture of a man being pulled out of the water. There's no clear presider in this event, but there is certainly a clear community. And somebody either with an alb to put on that guy come out of the water, or with a towel to dry him off, or maybe both, and burning candles. And in the background, an image of Moses striking water from the rock, of the empty tomb, of the ark surviving the flood, and of Jesus and the woman at the well. All three stories that matter hugely to the meaning of baptism. You can find more images like this throughout the book. But look at the beginning. Well, first, turn into that baptism section. And you'll see, first of all, our baptismal rite, replete, by the way, with the baptismal words on page 230, name, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And the possibility that the congregation might sing in response to that. Music for the song is included in the service music at pages at number 209 to 213. Either you belong to Christ in whom you have been baptized, or the congregation might sing after each baptism, Blessed be God, the source of all life, the word of salvation, the spirit of mercy. If you will, an alternative and orthodox Trinitarian naming. In response to the event of the baptism, where we have no pretension that we're going to replace the classic words of baptizing. Though that was for a while a discussion among us. Turn over the page again and notice this little rite, Welcome to Baptism. The presence of this rite in the book, a very much smaller version of it, was in the old Lutheran Book of Worship Occasional Services book, but now it's in the Pew edition, with the idea that baptism is a process, not just a single event. And a process, as Luther would say, that takes your life to do. And that somebody coming to baptism, either an adult coming to be baptized, or a family bringing a child to be baptized, might appropriately be welcomed to that process. If you will, to use older ecclesial language, welcomed to the catechumenate. And then the baptism scheduled at another time. One of the virtues of that is it's made possible for us to take seriously counsel that we've also noticed was in the prayer book, that baptisms might rightly be done at one of four great festivals in the year. Not just when the family, when grandma can get there, if you will. No, you might do the welcome to baptism when grandma can get there and do the baptism at the vigil. Or do the baptism at the Feast of Pentecost or the Feast of the Baptism of Our Lord or the Feast of All Saints. This was a kind of gift to our beginning to think that might be happening. In fact, that idea of baptism as a process is part of the thing that Neil called our attention to, and that is the idea of the increasing seeing that what's happened in the 20th century and will continue to happen in the 21st century is a greater and greater clarity about the centrality of baptism in our life. Here also in this section is the affirmation of baptism, which is used for lots of other purposes than confirmation, but includes the possibility of confirmation. And here is where we include corporate confession and forgiveness and individual confession and forgiveness, because by Lutheran understandings, these are baptismal offices. That absolution is nothing but a return to and taking up again the charge of baptism. But turn to the beginning of the Holy Communion section. No, one other thing. Turn to the beginning of the first section. Follow those first little red marks to the beginning of what's called propers. First, there's a calendar. It's a calendar that will be very familiar to you that we largely share with you. And if you were an Episcopalian. And then there's the list of lesser festivals and commemorations. Lutherans have gotten very interested in commemorations, in the saints, if you will. And if nothing else, they wind up showing up in the Sunday intercessions. There's more material actually coming to our core resource to help support the celebration of these lesser festivals and commemorations in our congregations as well. Then notice the propers. Here's where you'll find the Revised Common Lectionary. And here's where the psalm for the Sunday is indicated. And here is where the collects are. Not in a separate section for our Lutheran book. And what you need to know is that, in fact, the ELW occasioned us refreshing the entire collection of collects. The collects have been rearranged in relationship to the readings. And three have been appointed for any Sunday. So we now have a complete set of collects for the three-year lectionary. That relationship to the readings is not thematic. It picks up images from the readings, and in any case is a gathering collect, like the collect is, at the beginning of the liturgy, and then helps us turn toward hearing the word. These collects are made up of all the historic Western collects, and a great number of the Cranmerian collects, which we had not used, wind up being reworked here. And a number of new collects have been created or drawn from more recent sources. In any case, this refreshing of the collects is one of the most remarkable things that's in this book. A lot of study has been given to it, but I call your attention to it. Then turn, if you will, to page 65. And you'll find those texts of the other thanksgivings at the table that I mentioned to you. That means that there are now 10 full Eucharistic prayers in Lutheran practice, many of them fresh. The leading one, the one that's number one, is a revision of the prayer that appeared in 1958 in the service book and hymnal and was drafted by Luther Dotterer Reed. It's kind of the beginning of the recovery of Eucharistic praying in North American Lutheranism, reworked for this book. The prayer that was also, the prayers that were also in the LBW are here and reworked, but so are several new prayers, including the one I used at the Eucharist today. You will know that 11, not number 11 here, but number 2. Number 11 here is a Lutheran translation of the 4th, maybe 3rd century prayer that's attributed to Hippolytus of Rome, in any case to the so-called apostolic tradition. But number 2 in our book is a characteristic Lutheran unique practice, a way of giving thanks at the table that is this. First the dialogue, and then the preface, and then the Sanctus, and then the words of institution, and then the Lord's Prayer, and that's all. That's a Lutheran practice that came from Luther's profound rejection of the Roman canon, and I think came from a misreading of the way Luther reworked that canon in the first case, which was really not the end of Eucharistic praying, but a kind of very brief Eucharistic prayer. In any case, that's the way some Lutherans in this country give thanks at table. I want to say that most Lutherans who decide to do that don't do it for theological reasons, but do it for convenience. Do it because it's shorter. I'm really sorry about that. Especially when there is such a wealth of Eucharistic praying that's available, especially in this book. And in any case, if you're going to do that old Lutheran way, then I really urge you to do what's available to you in the leader's edition of the book, and that is to intone the words of institution, to sing them. Luther proposed that they should be sung to the gospel tone. And that's available in the ELW, so that, in fact, after preface and sanctus are sung, then the presider may sing the words of institution and the community sing the Lord's Prayer. It's, what shall I say, more Eucharistic, if you will, at the same time as more clearly proclamatory. But if you're one who uses the verba alone, if you will, that's in Lutheran practice, that's never what we actually mean. Though there have been some recent pastors who think it's clever to drop the preface and the Sanctus and the Lord's Prayer and just say the words of institution and start passing out the goods. I think that is such a medieval aberration, you know? It's such a misuse. I really hope it's not you doing that. In spite of what I said to you about thanking you, I won't thank you so much for that. I really urge you, if you're a verba alone person, to look at this treasure of Eucharistic prayer. And then one last thing, and I'd be glad for what questions you have in the time that remains. Look at the beginning of the Eucharist section. A major characteristic of this book is what you find on pages 92 and 93, and in fact find on this analogy in front of virtually every important rite in the book, and that is, before you get the rites, you get an ordo. This book is an ordo-based book, and it conceives the construction of the liturgy on the basis of a shared ecumenical ordo. Here is the ordo. With a little tiny theological explanation, the Holy Spirit calls us together as the people of God. God speaks to us in scripture reading, preaching, and song. God feeds us with the presence of Jesus Christ. God blesses us and sends us in mission to the world. This ordo is really the interpretive key to this book, and a way it can be taught, and a way that Eucharistic planning can be, that liturgical planning can be made. By the way, I remember actually sitting once with Neil in Suwannee with Marion Hatchett, and hearing Marion Hatchett say to me, commentary on the American Prayer Book author, one of the major figures in the formation of the American Prayer Book, having Marion Hatchett say to me, those pages 401 that Neil had you look at earlier today, those pages are, said Marion, the hermeneutical key of the prayer book. I love that. That was already an ordo. Now it was forbidden, over Marion's objections, it was forbidden for Sunday use. But it was already, for Marion, the prayer book had an ordo base. ELW has an ordo base in spades, and it's a major reason, maybe even the basic reason, why, combined with the language reasons I've already talked about, why we needed to, in fact, step on beyond the LBW to creating this book. Let me stop there. There's lots more to say. Scratch a liturgy professor and you get an outflowing of blood or something. But questions would be wonderful, please.
Could you say something about Holy Week and the differences between the prayer book and the...
Would I say something about the Holy Week and the differences between the prayer book and what's in the ELW? The differences are minor. The rites for Good Friday and for the Maundy for Maundy Thursday are extremely similar. The ELW has a special accent on confession and reconciliation on Maundy Thursday, but the larger differences are probably in the vigil. And those differences include that the prayer book has only 9 readings and the ELW has 12. And the 12 that the ELW has are the old readings that were listed in the earliest list of readings we have from Jerusalem and the so-called Armenian lectionary. And they end, and this is a big deal for Lutherans, they end with the 12th reading being the story of the three children in the fiery furnace. That's a major Easter Vigil event in Lutheran practice. And even though our book says, like the prayer book, that if you're going to leave out readings, and our congregations regularly do, the congregation I belong to reads 7 of those 12, that the ones that have to be included are the creation account and the Exodus account. I would say many Lutheran congregations think, and the three children in the fiery furnace. The other thing that's happened in the ELW version of the vigil is that the New Testament readings, the reading from Romans and the Gospel, continue right on from the Old Testament readings, from the 2 to 12 Old Testament readings. And there's not an interruption of the baptismal rite. And with the New Testament readings moved to the Eucharistic rite in the church, if you will. Rather, the readings are all one, and then we move to baptism, or the remembrance of baptism, and then we move to the table. The best way in which the liturgy of the vigil in the ELW would be enacted would be stational. That is to say, you do the light service, the fire in one place, move to a place where you do the light service, and in that place, near the Paschal candle, you read all the readings, then you move to the font, do the baptismal remembrance, and then you move to the table and do the Eucharist. Though a lot of congregations don't necessarily follow that pattern, the ELW is really conceived of in a stational way. That would be the major thing, I'd say, that is different. I would say this, however. My guess is that we are only slowly growing in the use of the vigil. Or if all the liturgies of the 3 days. And I would really urge you, Lutherans in the room, to take seriously this amazing gift. In the ELW, this is at the heart of what the book is, and part of why we published it in the book. Part of why I urge us to put the book in the hands of the people so people know it's there. You know? Do think seriously about doing the liturgy of the 3 days. And if you've not had a chance to think about it, look at that handbook for Lent and the 3 days, or one of the Worship Matters series that Augsburg Fortress publishes is a book called A 3 Day Feast, written by Gail Ramshaw, who I happen to know, and it's a really good book. So, another question, please. Yeah. Yep.
We baptize into different traditions.
Yeah.
Could you please speak to a regular unified baptismal bite for a community that sees itself as unified but honoring different traditions?
That's really interesting. Now, I hope what you do is you baptize into the Church of Jesus Christ. You don't baptize Episcopalians or Lutherans. They live out that baptism in Episcopalian and Lutheran.
Talking to Paul in confirmation
language. Yeah, I got it. Let me bracket that and wait until Neil gives his response, and then there's supposed to be question and answer time after that, and let's put that on the agenda for both of us to respond to right then, okay? The question of common baptismal rite. Great question. Please.
What resources do you have in Spanish?
I'm trying to remember the name of it. The LBW, pardon? Precisely. The LBW was translated into Spanish. It was actually translated at a time when the materials of the LBW were already, as it were, on the way toward what was going to become the ELW. In the process, there has been a continued attention to Spanish translation, as well as other language translations, Chinese, for example. But the use of the means of grace document, for example, has been translated into Spanish. Several of the pastoral rites and pastoral care have been translated into Spanish. Libro Liturgia et something. Libro Liturgia e something or another. So there are a number of Spanish language resources. In addition, the one of the musical settings in the ELW was a setting that was first popularized in Spanish language congregations, and it's a kind of music that is culturally accessible in some Hispanic places, and there are hymns in the ELW which are printed multilingually. Spanish being the principal one, but there are many other languages that you find also in the ELW. So, yes, please.
When you were taking this on a tour of the table of contents, one omission that I think is interesting, there's no comparable category of the Lutheran book for the Episcopal services.
That's right. That's right. No. It's in a second occasional services book. There's actually two occasional services book, one called Pastoral Care, and one, a larger volume, which is called Occasional Services for the Congregation. And the ordinal for us is in that book. It's also, some of it is in the Pastoral Care book, this kind of shared publication. But the ordinal has never been published in our major congregational resource. It's been in occasional services materials.
Is there a theological premise there?
Yeah, I think you'd probably be able to give that theological premise yourself. That is to say, the ordinal matters to the identity of the Episcopal Church in a way that it does not matter to the identity of the Lutheran Church. The confessions matter. The gospel matters. Now, we ordain people. We lay on hands and pray for the Spirit to raise up this person. And we install bishops. But in a rite which could be liturgically interpreted as ordination or consecration, we just don't interpret it that way. We usually call it an installation. But it includes laying on hands of prayer, and laying on hands of prayer by more than one bishop in communion with the whole church, as much of the church as we can. But it doesn't have the anchoring center to why, in fact, your church is called Episcopal. Our church is moving toward an Episcopal order, but it isn't. It hasn't made it to the center of our identity. Lutherans generally still teach there is one office of ministry. Now, we're working on what we mean by that and how that relates to things like diaconal ministries, or the ministry of a bishop. And whether the ministry of the bishop and the ministry of the pastor is the same ministry, it's a little argument that Lutherans have. But it's not sort of at the identifying center. I don't know. Catherine, did I do okay on that? Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Great.
Yes, sure. Oh. Yeah, that was probably striking to you, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm a little sorry for him to say that. In fact, he's literally right. When a bishop is out of office, he's not a bishop anymore. But the honest truth is, you and the Moravians, for that matter, who also believe in lifelong bishops, have some existential truth on your side. When I've met retired bishops who, for example, moved on to being parish pastors again, it always seems to me that they're trailing the clouds a little bit of their former bishopric. People still, they do like you do. How shall I address you? I think if somebody has functioned as a bishop in the church, it doesn't just go away. I certainly think if you function as a pastor in the church, it doesn't just go away. But officially Richard Bansimer with great right. Yeah, Catherine. Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Could you address the relation to bishops? I know there was some discussion that Lutherans should decide that if a bishop passed out of office and then was a bishop again.
Yeah. Or moved from synod to synod. I mean that.
That person would not be installed in the same way with the laying on the
court. Yeah. Yeah. I think, in fact, the truth is we might want to think about that more, but probably my response would be to say I still believe in the unrepeatability, but I don't have any problem with laying hands on and praying more times. You know, the more prayers, the better. I don't think that has to be automatically understood as contradicting unrepeatability. If a bishop moves from Michigan to New York City, as one we know did, that bishop is installed in the new situation in a way in which hands are laid on and prayed for that bishop, I suppose I would spend less time worrying about whether there's a number of ecumenical representatives and the whole church is present to do the old Nicene guarantee about the number of bishops involved in the ordination of a bishop. But I wouldn't have a problem with laying on of hands and praying again. I was installed in a new parish, and I don't know, the bishops decided they were going to lay hands on me. I'd been pastor for a long time, and I thought, this is odd, and then I thought, the old way you indicate who you're praying for is you put your hands on them. That's all. So I wouldn't make too much of a thing about that. Well, I would agree with you about the unrepeatability. So, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we should work on the clarity of the rite. So let me stop and ask Neil to respond. Please remember your question, and we will come back.
I'll be brief, given the hour and the fact we want to do questions. Just a couple of reflections. I think Gordon's explanation of the use of the means of grace and how that played into the whole thing, and I think your phrase was as close to canons as we get, but they really aren't. I think that distinction is worth thinking about a bit. As I mentioned very much in passing this morning, the Book of Common Prayer is for Episcopalians part of the Constitution of the Church. And so when one, for example, in the Ordinal, one in the Oath of Conformity, one says, and I promise to conduct my ministry according to the doctrine, discipline, and worship of the Church, the answer to that question is the Constitutional Prayer Book of the Church. That doesn't mean that the General Convention from time to time doesn't authorize additional rites, additional music, and other kinds of things. So there's not just the prayer book. There's also a library of other liturgical materials that parishes have the freedom to use. Some of that freedom is church-wide. sometimes in the Episcopal Church, in order to get those materials approved, we had to put a provision in the enabling resolution at the convention that basically says, with the permission of the ordinary, which is to say, with the permission of the bishop. So the Bishop of Virginia may say, oh, of course, I like those new Eucharistic prayers, or I like those new canticles for the offices. You're free to use those, or you're free to use them in this manner. But then the Bishop of, let's say, Fond du Lac may say, you're not free to use those materials. I want you to only use these others. and they're not there, so they're available for church-wide use, but may not be allowed to be used in that way. But I do think it creates a slightly different consciousness about how the book is seen in the life of the church. So I've got a theory about this. And this is an observation, and I admit the Lutheran side of this observation is some decades old now, though I've not lost all my friends and colleagues and connections in the church. I actually think that while the ELW may be technically gives a great deal more freedom in terms of its use than the prayer book does, I suspect actually in practice, more Lutheran churches do something on a Sunday morning that is in the general orbit of what is anticipated by the ELW than may be the case in many parts of the Episcopal Church with respect to the prayer book. Now, part of the genius of the American prayer book tradition, and this is a matter about which I have some strength of opinion, is having spent a lot of time, as has Bishop Ted and others, traveling the Anglican Communion, having spent a lot of time in Africa and a lot of places around the globe, where a lot of the theological and churchmanship fights of the 16th century are still going on. I remember standing, I was in Uganda, and I was having a conversation with, I was there to do some teaching in their House of Bishops 10 years ago. And I was standing there in the break talking to two bishops, and I noticed after a few minutes that this one was talking to me and this one was talking to me, but they were not talking to each other. Now, so I'm a visiting fireman. I'm leaving. I called them on it. And I said, why don't you talk to each other? Why are you talking through me? And one of them, he just piped right at me. He said, well, I'm a Catholic Anglican bishop. My diocese was founded by the SPG, Society for the Propagation of the Gospel. And he is an evangelical bishop whose diocese was founded by the CMS, Church Missionary Society. And we have nothing to say to each other. And we say, and they say, well, you're in the same damn House of Bishops. How can you not talk to one another? But that was business as usual for them. And that was, I mean, I was not telling them anything they didn't know. Well, it's interesting, and you can still to this day, I don't know whether Gordon would agree with me, but if you take Common Worship, the new alternative prayer book for the Church of England, if you kind of know what you're looking for, you can flip through Common Worship, which has many virtues, but it also has many, many weaknesses, in my judgment. But if you know what you're looking for, you can say, well, you can still look at the brand new book of the Church of England and go, well, you know, the Protestant side of the church won that page. And the Catholic side of the church won that page. You know? Well, one of the blessed gifts of the American Episcopal Church is from our very first prayer book in 1789, largely because we figured out a way to compromise some of these things, and not compromise the faith of the church, but figure out how to ritualize some of this stuff slightly differently through Scotland rather than through England. What that has enabled is a kind of hybrid prayer book, where, yes, there are Catholic elements, yes, there are more Protestant elements. The breadth of the Anglican tradition across that field is still to be found. But it has been woven together. It has created a tapestry that is really hard to sort out. But that gives the freedom for a parish or a part of the church that does have, more Catholic leanings, if you will, to use the same book, and yet to enact that musically and ritually in ways, and then down the road or the next diocese over, a group of folks with whom you are still in absolute communion, in charity, in love, in mission, in work, but who have certain other ritual and musical and other kinds of sensibilities, to live together in a kind of tapestry that actually works. and actually often creates a kind of energy out of that. And so what sometimes may look like really different things are actually probably woven together tighter than they may at first appear. Whereas I'm sad to say in other parts of our communion, those differences that may seem to be there on the surface are really there much, much further down. So the marvelous gift of this, yes, it's part of the Constitution, but I really do think that we have things to learn. And I don't suspect Episcopalians are going to change their canonical and constitutional way of thinking about prayer book worship. But I think back to 1976, you know, I was the bishop of a diocese where my predecessor, three times removed, he just declared, first Sunday of Advent of that year, every parish was using that book. All the 1928 prayer books had to go. Period, whatever. And he lost three congregations over that. Now, 30 plus years later, part of that was also the right decision. It was a painful thing, losing three congregations. It wasn't very pastoral. There were some issues around all that. But then 35 years later, the diocese there is whole, is together, is unified, works together, and in some of the crises of the last 12 years or so, has weathered that extremely well with no more defections. And that's largely because of some of the fabric building that has gone on around the prayer book. So it was a hard decision on the beginning. A neighboring diocese to me in the southeast that shall remain nameless, that bishop took a different tact and said, this is our book, this is the authority by which we live, but sort of when you put it into place, we'll make that a local option. And there are still to this day five congregations that haven't yet moved to this book, and we're about to move to the next one. And interestingly enough, the disunity and pain and anger of the last 10 or 12 years in the church has been magnified in that situation. And it's at least partially about the lack of discipline around those kinds of things. Anyway, those are just some random thoughts. I want to say something, and Gordon was talking about the various levels of rubrics in the ELW, and the ones that are sort of in the book, and then the ones that are in the leader's edition, and then the ones that are in the commentary on the leader's edition. The various levels of that. I think that's we have a very similar thing in this, except that those commentaries and so forth tend to be by individual persons who represent various viewpoints in the church, like Ma, they don't perhaps have quite the official imprimatur that some of these do. But I do want to say a little bit about the rubrics in the prayer book, because one of my predecessors is a professor of liturgy back in the late 1800s. One part of his title was Professor of Christian Worship and the Science of Rubrics. And so if I have some issues, I inherited them. But what's interesting is if you look back into the prayer book tradition, this particular prayer book, 1979 American, is at once, at the same time, both the most directive prayer book in the history of the tradition, while at the same time being the most gelatinous. In other words, giving you more options. The book gives you more ways around the rubrics than any previous prayer book. That's point one. Point two, though, some years ago, the students of Lee Mitchell at Seabury Western Seminary in Evanston, Illinois, had T-shirts made after his liturgy class, that said, do something radical for Jesus. And on the back it said, obey the rubrics. But one of the interesting things that I try to talk to my students about is rubrics basically come in two different kind of flavors. But sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference. One flavor is simply a directive. Stand, sit, do this, go there, say this, don't say that. You know, I mean, the ones that are sort of fairly clearly ritual rubrics. But then they're also what I think of as theological rubrics, where the theology, part of the explanation of what's going on in this part of the rite theologically, is actually, you know, the substance may be carried by the prayer or by the formula or whatever, but the rubric's actually carrying some of the theology. And when I say that it's sometimes hard to tell the difference, it's because even a rubric about stand, sit, or kneel may actually be carrying a theological interpretation. The best example, I think, of that in the prayer book. Well, there are many examples, but one let me just describe for you. And that is in the ordination of a deacon, a priest, or a bishop. When it's time, when all the examinations and other promises and oaths and all that has been concluded, then the congregation stands and sings some version of Veni Sancti Spiritus, come Holy Spirit, right? And then an invitation of the Spirit to come be present in this moment. And the rubric is very clear to say the congregation is standing. And then there's a long period of silence, which in my judgment is actually the ordination prayer begins with the singing of come Holy Spirit. And then the congregation continues to pray during the silence. That ought to be rather plenteous. And then what we think of as the ordination prayer is what brings all that praying that started back up with Veni Sancti Spiritus, and that long silent prayer where the people of God are praying for a new priest. Then it all kind of, but through that whole thing, the prayer book's very clear that the congregation is standing. Why? Because the congregation is praying here. I mean, if this was something that simply the bishop was going to do, this person was going to kneel down and the bishop was going to dispense something here, then why wouldn't you want the congregation to sit down and watch? But the prayer book's been very clear. No. The congregation through this entire action must be standing because they're not auxiliary to the action. They are praying through this whole time. Praying mightily with their chief pastor that the Spirit will pour afresh upon this person and make them a priest. And so what seems like just a directive, the people will stand, is actually bearing fairly significant theological weight at that point. That's all to say a rubric is not just a rubric. For those of you who are Lutherans working with Episcopal congregations, Gordon mentioned a few resources, and I would like to add a couple. Because our book is now older than the LBW, a lot of our commentaries came out on the front end of that. And then the commentaries slowed down for a while. There is a new set of commentaries, however, just in the last couple of years. They're all available from Church Publishing. It's a four-volume set, though only three volumes have thus far appeared. One is a wonderful, freshly thought-through volume on the celebration of the Eucharist and the Prayer Book by Pat Malloy, who is now the interim dean of the cathedral in Denver, former professor of liturgy at the General Seminary in New York. A wonderful, fresh thinking about that. And then there's another volume on the initiation rites, on baptism, confirmation, things related to that, both ceremonially and in the liturgy, as well as some catechetical materials that are helpful. And that is done by Jim Terrell, who is professor of liturgy at Suwannee with me. And then the third volume of that set is about liturgical time in the prayer book, which is to say the rites of Holy Week, the time dimensions of the calendar, of the Eucharist, of the various other rites, and yours truly wrote that volume. And then there's a fourth volume on the pastoral rites, weddings, funerals, those kinds of things, that is in preparation and will be out soon, we hope. That's not to say that some of the earlier volumes, like the commentary on the prayer book and some earlier manuals of instruction on the prayer book by people like Lee Mitchell and others, are not still useful. But they are a little closer to the beginning of the life of the book. And I think these newer volumes, I think, reflect sort of how the church has developed. And each of these volumes in their own way also begin to look forward to what might be coming, what we hope might be coming. Which ones? If you go to the church publishing website, and Celebrating the Eucharist, I believe, is the title of Pat's book, and then Celebrating the Rites of Christian Initiation is Jim's book, and Celebrating Liturgical Time is my volume. The fourth volume will be Celebrating the Pastoral. I'm not sure they've arrived at the final title, but it's essentially will be Celebrating the Pastoral Rites. Just one or two other things. I'm grateful to Gordon for his interpretation of whatever influence our very long and very drawn out and very difficult conversations on confirmation and reception and reaffirmation may have had on Lutheran reforms. I'm glad it was useful to someone. Because it continues to be a very difficult conversation among Episcopalians. I was, frankly, as not only as a bishop of the church, but as a liturgics professor who taught a significant number of the bishops of the church when they were in seminary, several years ago, the theology committee of the House of Bishops did a study of confirmation practices among the bishops of the Episcopal Church, and then reported their findings to the House of Bishops. It's the only time in my 15 years in the House of Bishops I wanted to run out the back door screaming. It's very clear that a significant portion of the House of Bishops do not understand the canons on church membership, do not understand the rubrics of the Book of Common Prayer, do not understand the initiation theology that undergirds the Book of Common Prayer. It's incomplete as it is. I mean, we would all like for it to go to the next level, but even to the level it has come, don't understand it. And are simply following patterns that perhaps were in force in the church when they were teenagers or something, and it was a mortifying and embarrassing revelation, and again it probably hit me with a double dose, because I taught many of them in seminary, and I know at least they heard it. Whether they learned it or not, I don't know, but they heard it. And then I'm also the teacher, the liturgy teacher for the College for Bishops, for the new bishops. We have a 3-year training program, and I teach all that material there. And many of them go, aye, aye, sir, and move right on. So anyway, but it's still a very active conversation. It's a conversation in the Episcopal Church I worry about, because I think we've lost our moorings theologically around some of those issues, and we've got to rethink them and rework them, and so anyway I'm glad it was some use, and I hope maybe we can pick up some of your materials and move forward. It's a very unhappy and painful sort of thing. I want to comment quickly on the Daily Office Lectionary. I was interested to see how sold Gordon is on the new pattern in the Daily Office Lectionary in ELW. And I'm anxious to see, I on the surface, I think it sounds marvelous. I'm anxious to see how well it wears over time. And that's not to throw any cold water on what's there at all. I haven't used it personally. I look forward to using it and getting more familiar with it. The thing that immediately came to mind, though, and again, I think there's an obvious answer to this. But you know, one of the as a person who is in a community that prays the daily office every day, you know, one of the frustrations and one of the gifts of the current daily office lectionary in the prayer book. It is not coordinated with the liturgical year. It is not coordinated with Sunday. And so sometimes you'll be right there in the middle of Advent and there comes the crucifixion. Or you'll be, you know, right smack in the week before Holy Week and all of a sudden, there's an angel talking to Mary. It's a kind of, and yet I've learned, and maybe it's just because I've prayed it for 30 years, but there's a certain grace in those collisions as well. And while I think there's much grace in the coordination of all this, so it anticipates and continues to reflect on the Sundays. And as I talked this morning, I'm a great believer in the primacy of Sunday. So all that sounds really great, but I just at least have to ask the question, what's the cost? Will there be some costs on the other side of that ledger? And maybe so, maybe not. We'll only know, you know, one never knows about liturgical rites until they've had about 25 or 30 years of pastoral use, you know. And then you begin to know whether they're really cooking or not. I'm happy to say one of the things that Episcopalians, not so much Anglicans worldwide, but Episcopalians, tend to be anxious about is the structure of the Eucharistic prayer, and except for the one with the second option, I think, in the ELW that Gordon addressed so eloquently, and which I have a deep appreciation for. My understanding of what Luther did, you know, that one of the great debates with people like Gordon and myself, we often debate, you know. Was the option in the Reformation that the Lutherans and certain other families of the Reformation took of basically sticking solely with the words of institution, was that in continuity or discontinuity with what went before it? Well, I'm in the club that says what Luther did there, he did for all kinds of very sound pastoral and theological reasons. But he was also a man of his age, taking what he had inherited to its obvious conclusion, theologically and otherwise, there is the argument on the other side of that. I understand, but I see that Gordon may not remember this encounter, but as I told you this morning, I remember much more about him than he'll ever remember about me. Sometime in the early 80s, when we were working on the interim Eucharistic sharing agreements, the very early agreements in our old church bodies, old LCA and ALC and AELC and so forth, and the Episcopal Church, one of the things that those of us who were liturgical teachers in the two churches were asked to do was to analyze the new Eucharistic prayers in the LBW and write reports to the Ecumenical Commission or somebody, I don't remember, about which prayers in the LBW would be satisfactory for joint worship with Episcopalians. And like Pavlov's dogs, all the Episcopalian scholars just said, well, there's a certain structure of the Eucharistic prayer and it has to follow and whatever. Gordon and I were at a meeting where I was, you know, sharing my thoughts on the matter. And I could see Gordon grinning like a Cheshire cat, so I knew I was in trouble. And he said, well, Neil, what about prayer C? Do you remember that? and I said, yeah, I give up. I said, okay, but you know, prayer 1, prayer 2, prayer A, prayer B, and prayer D are all okay. You know, one of my students heard me tell that story one time, and they said, well, then, if prayer C doesn't consecrate, why do we use it? And I said, I never said it didn't consecrate. But I said it doesn't consecrate because it has a historically authoritative, clear, theologically lucid, theological structure. It consecrates by the authority of the General Convention. So anyway, two final comments. One is the question back here about the Triduum liturgies, and I agree with Gordon almost entirely. Well, on the Triduum liturgies, I do agree. When I picked up the ELW, the first thing I looked to with fear and trepidation was Ash Wednesday. I actually went on record in my recent book to say that I think the Ash Wednesday liturgy of the 1979 prayer book is just flat wrong, and that we should take a cue from the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics and others. And now the ELW has changed the structure of the Ash Wednesday rite to be like ours, or to be the same as ours, not like ours. And boy, I wish y'all could fix that so we could fix it too. I just have real issues with, I just think ritually Ash Wednesday makes much more sense if the elocution to the people and the imposition of ashes comes before the gospel, before the word liturgy, so that the word liturgy can interpret all of that, rather than be there and then do the other ritual action. And in my pastoral ministry, I've had to explain that to a lot of people, that I think the reverse is easier. I had a much easier time explaining that as a Lutheran pastor in LBW days than I have in the prayer book. So I was disappointed in that change. In the economy of liturgical renewal, that's pretty small. The other thing I was hoping for there, and I will pray and hope for in the prayer book revision, is that at least, if not replace the gospel for Ash Wednesday, at least have an alternative for the gospel for Ash Wednesday. The lesson that the church chose for the first day of Lent was the Pharisee and the publican, which is a marvelous gospel for Ash Wednesday. And then when that was only 36 days, though, because it was the Monday after the first Sunday. And so when we move back to Wednesday before Ash Wednesday, the Matthew 6 gospel was already there, and that they saw no reason to change it. But it didn't have the same intentionality to begin our Lenten journey as the Pharisee and the publican did, which strikes me as at least a whole alternative. And so forth. And finally, and this is really dangerous territory, but the question came up in ministry and the sort of ministry of word and sacrament in the Lutheran tradition, and it's, you know, one order of ministry that and we all know that story. But I just think it's important for Episcopalians, and frankly I think it's important for Roman Catholics, to really come clean. I mean, anybody with three orders of ministry, whether that's the Roman Catholic, you know, post-Durandus three orders of ministry, meaning subdeacon, deacon, and priest, or whether Anglicans, meaning deacon, priest, and bishop, we simply have to come clean that the Reformation churches, the Lutherans in particular, and others who ended up with a one order office of word and sacrament, that part of what that is historically is simply truth-telling. Take the Anglican picture clearly. If you look at our rites, and if you look even, you look at Bucer's influence on Cranmer and so forth, if you look at Anglican ordinals right down to the 1979 prayer book, up to the 1979 prayer book, what do you see there? You really had one order of ministry with two variations. Even the language underscored that. The only order in previous Anglican ordinals that was ordained was what? The priesthood. Deacons were made. Bishops were consecrated. The prayer book was very clear that the diaconate and the episcopate were simply variations on the priesthood, variations on the presbyterate. It was a one office ministry with two variations, not three distinct separate orders of ministry as we saw in earlier times in the church, and the picture of ministry that the 1979 prayer book tries to lay out. Now, I can. That's a subject about which I have an enormous amount of passion and an enormous amount of minutia to share, and I won't do that. I'll resist that temptation. But you know, I'm always conscious when I'm in certain ecumenical conversations that those of us who are a three sacred ministers ordered church can often have a certain level of arrogance about that that really displays our own ignorance of our own history and development. So I believe that what happened in Lutheranism is frankly an honest version of what happened among Anglicans. We simply weren't willing to say so. And then we continued the following centuries through this sort of romantic apologia for that. But we deeply believed it. And finally, in the revision of the Ordinal in the 1979 prayer book, and it's not a complete piece of work. Thank you, Gordon, for encouraging us. We got more work to do. The Ordinal needs to take the next step or two in revision. But at least it got clear about three separate orders of ministry with three very distinct charisms of ministry, three very distinct responsibilities for the health and welfare and the life of the church. I think you can read Rome's Ordinal in much the same way. I just think we need to be honest about that. Yeah, back to you now.
Dear friends, why don't you stand up and take a deep breath, but don't go away. And in 4 minutes, we'll start by answering that question about baptism and then take a few more questions and then break and go to discussion groups, okay?